In the Creekside Room this afternoon, we have Jane Frankenberger. Today's session number is 98.3, and it's titled, Using Satellites to Guide Our Feet, GPS in Work and Play. Let's listen in.
I'm a user of global positioning systems, like many of you may be, or many of you may have barely heard of it and don't know what it is at all. And this session is certainly appropriate for you at any level. Just to sort of run through what we're going to do is, first we're going to talk a little bit about the applications and why this technology is a good thing for everybody to be just a tiny bit familiar with. And then I'm going to go through how it actually works, because there's an awful lot of people using it that don't know how it works, and that's no big problem. Like, we use so many things each day that we don't really know how they work, but I just think global positioning system is so absolutely astounding that we can be receiving our position, you know, from the satellites so precisely, that I think it's interesting to know a little bit about it. And then we'll talk about what kind of errors we expect when we're using it and where those come from and how you can deal with the errors if you need to be really precise. And then, after we talk about how it works, then we're going to do what I said was the hands-on. I brought one, you know, fairly inexpensive little receiver here, and it's trying it out, it can pick up, what you need is at least 4 satellites at a time, and it can pick them up. So we'll go outside and can pass that around. I borrowed another one, and we have not yet been able to get a fix with enough satellites on that one, but we can keep trying. So since there's a lot of people, that gives more people hands-on, and I'm not sure why it can't seem to pick up 4 satellites. And then, what was your name again?
Rich.
Rich, who is the repair associate here, has brought a wonderful system, which is his GPS receiver, which is over there, and then it's hooked up to a computer with a mapping program, and so it can show you how you would use it in a car, especially, I think, is what you would do with that as you're traveling along. So we can look at that, and people can see how that works, too. So we'll sort of, you know, make it informal at the end and break up and give people a chance to use it. So how many people have used a GPS before? So you have no idea. Okay, so we're definitely not starting at the beginning for some, but some haven't. So I assume that you are, like, you know, most people, moderately intrigued by the fact that we can do so much with a little receiver like this. And as I said, I thought we'd talk about the applications first. They say that the GPS is one of the fastest technologies accepted ever, because it has gone so fast from the world of, you know, just something out there and, you know, theoretically possible but not really feasible, to the state where we can hold it in our hands and, in fact, we can buy it for under $200. It continues, like all new technologies, to grow in money and to shrink in size, as all new electronics technologies are. There was just an article in the New York Times that's out there hanging on the rack, that they're working hard to put this into the size of something that can go in other applications, you know, credit card size or something like that, that it could all go on a large chip. And the reason that that would be so helpful, you know, some of these applications are more useful than others, but they thought that, for example, car security, it could be eventually a form of car security, that you would put it on your car and the car would know if it's traveling without your authorization, and then it could shut itself off or whatever. And one of the reasons that they're working so hard on the small-scale version of this is to go on cellular phones, because apparently there's a law in place, I hadn't heard this before, that requires cellular phones to be able to communicate their location for 911 calls within a few years, because currently that's such a problem, right? We're used to calling 911, but the 911 system can't respond to cellular phone calls because they don't know where they are. So that GPS is one of the ways that might happen. Apparently there's a competing technology also which would go with the cellular phones, own network of you would communicate that way to get within a certain position. But many people are advocating just regular old GPS inside the cellular phone as the way for it to be able to communicate its locations. So they think that it will be, the price will be under $10 sometime soon after the year 2000, sometime early in the next century. So, you know, once it gets under $10, then we'll, you know, it'll show up everywhere, like computer chips are now, and every other application that you can imagine. What applications are you interested in? Either those of you who have already used it, or people maybe who are thinking about it. What applications are of interest?
Mm-hmm. Well, hiking, I mean, that's primarily what I think. Anytime I go out in the woods, skiing in the winter, whatever, just keep bearings and where I'm at, where I want to go.
Yeah, and that's certainly one of the main recreational uses. And when I called this, you know, GPS for work and play, that's certainly one of the main applications I was thinking of. So that's good. Being up here at home is ideal. Others?
What about active surveying? Can you do active surveying with GPS?
Accurate
surveying. Can you survey accurately?
Yes, absolutely.
Sure.
And that's certainly one of, you know, it's revolutionized the world of surveying. Mm-hmm. The things that they used to focus on, they don't need to focus on anymore. Now they need to focus more on getting the accuracy that they need with these systems. But with the right system and with a differential, you know, a base station, we'll talk about that soon if that is a familiar word to you, so that you have a reference point, they can get to about a few centimeters of accuracy at this point. So they're very highly accurate. This one is not. This one we get within 100 meters. So we're talking, 300 feet. It's a much less accurate thing. You would not survey with this.
No.
But you can survey with GPS. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Others?
We use them for consolidated freightways, parking company.
Sure.
Our team driver that's out across the state.
And they each have a unit in the truck?
Yeah, we also talk with them. So we can tell whether it's monitored, I think, every 15 minutes.
Okay, and this is in place now. So it's what, radio impact to you? Its location, something like that?
Yeah, we track the word.
Okay, and that's another thing that they feel certainly will grow in coming years, that would be, you know, now I don't know how much it costs you to get this set up. It's a substantial investment, but it would certainly, that would something that would come down, but it's beneficial in many businesses. Uh-huh.
Our applications are much like the surveying applications he mentioned, except they're in geophysical surveys, airborne, ground, or marine surveys, where we used to spend tens of thousands of dollars a month for electronic positioning. We've now beautifully done with GPS.
Oh, terrific. Okay, can you give an example of what kind of geophysical surveying
Seismic surveying on land or marine. Airborne magnetic surveys, gravity surveys, but all require accurate positioning. We used to pay a bundle for electronic positioning, but now we can do portable.
Okay, well, that's good to have that perspective, because yeah, it has certainly changed when I've read about it, certainly not done myself, but where they're trying to even measure movement along fault lines, it allows us that centimeter accuracy to measure whether the earth is moving, right? And so you can actually establish those kind of points besides the surveys in motion. So that's a great one. Others?
Once they get small enough, you can use it for tracking your kids.
Sure, why not? I mean, again, we have to have that communications method, whatever he's got. So you've got to get it sent back to you somehow. And I don't know if that would be in the cellular phone
or your
would it be
pets,
on the radio receiver.
Your spouse, whoever.
Are we looking at a day when if you go hiking, the National Forest will require you to have that as a safety device? So they won't have the expensive saving. Well, they have the expensive saving people right now looking for them. This would eliminate.
Well, there was a case in the Cascades where out of Seattle. It was about 3 years ago, and somebody had a cellular phone and a GPS, but they didn't have a map. For the maps they had, they couldn't coordinate to the GPS coordinate. And they were able to call out their coordinate, and the search and rescue was able to come in and get them.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so I guess along with the GPS, you have to have a cellular phone. And I'm not up on cellular phones at all, but my understanding is that you can't communicate here by cellular phone. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so that's still a problem. But I do know, related to that, that when was it a Marine got shot down in Bosnia?
Right.
Scott O'Grady, he had his GPS unit and his radio at that point, and he had just barely enough batteries, and at night he would turn it on and wait for those satellites to come in, and finally it was like the fourth night before he could get his position from his GPS, but then he could get it and he could radio out, and so that's how they knew where he was. So those are all.
The Hertz Never Lost system, I believe, uses GPS. The little thing in your car, and it has a little stalk between the driver and the passenger, and it has a little map of where you are, and you can tell it where you want to go, and it'll tell you when to turn right and when to turn left. And
this is in a rental car?
Yeah.
Is that what it is? You rent a car. Okay.
And you pay an extra whatever, and you can get the Never Lost. And so it's interesting. It's fun using cars to get your location if you're in an unusual, unaccustomed area.
Probably integrates a street atlas and a GPS system.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's where it's really ideal, because we do have those good street atlases, and I think most of the car companies are figuring that will become more widespread.
Of course, they're used widely in marine use, and you'll have a marine chart, and then usually built into the GPS unit, you'll have the marine chart, and then you can just drive right up to your berth almost, if it's foggy ocean.
Yeah. Apparently, you know, I don't do a lot of boating myself, but it's that much harder to find your way or your place, or they say even back to your favorite fishing hole in a lake, you can easily locate with GPS where there's no good way now, you can't look for landmarks. So that's certainly an important application.
Do you think it works underwater? Would a scuba diving application work?
No.
No, the
microwaves can't penetrate the water. They don't penetrate buildings very well, and they don't penetrate trees very well.
Trees?
Yeah.
Right.
Because I used mine out in Alaska in the forest, and I could not get a fix on any satellites.
Because you were under trees? Was that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's a real challenge. I mean, and you've got the mountains on the side, so we're already blocked here somewhat. Buildings, I mean, that's the problem that's more written about is when you're in downtown Manhattan and you've got skyscrapers on either side, it's real hard to get your fix, too. But those are the kind of the problems. The one that I'm the most familiar with, this is what we use back in Indiana, and a lot of people in my department are working on it, is called precision agriculture. And there's the ag economist nodding back there, and I don't really have an easy way to show this, but what you can see very small here, farmers are attaching these to their combines with a yield monitor, and then as they combine up and down, back and forth on their fields, it's measuring every second is a typical interval, what their yield is and what their position is, and then when they're done, they get a map like this that shows where the yield is high and where it's low, and then they look back and they try and figure out, okay, why is the yield higher in this place than this place? And then more practically, probably, is they often do soil sampling with a location like this before the season starts. They go back and take all the soil samples so that they have a map of fertility levels in the soil, and then they can, what's called precision apply their fertilizer exactly according to what the soil needs in that particular part of the field. So a lot of work is going on that in Indiana. It's another one of those technologies that may make it harder for some of the smaller farmers, but it does have the possibility as well of helping the environment, and that's sort of why I look at it. What are the water quality effects of precision applying your fertilizer so that you know that you're getting just the right amount, just where you need it? And there's a lot of connections with drainage too, which is the other thing that I work on. So people are looking at what it means about different drainage levels in different parts of the field. So that's one of the big applications. Well, that's a lot of applications, but I thought we would take some time to think about how it works. So that in all of our future lives, as we use this technology, most people will just be using it blindly, which is fine, but we'll have some idea of how it works. Okay, so to start out, how do we get our location from the satellites? I think most of you have some idea. There's a word called triangulation. That means we can find our exact position if we know our distance from a certain number of points. Like, for example, if I said, go to all of you, go to a point that's 150 feet from the village center door and 160 feet from the door of Koinonia, would you all go to the same point?
No.
No.
We should. Oh, you should, but you wouldn't. Okay. Well, okay, yeah, that's true. All right, what if you actually could? You have to think how you would do it, first of all. You might, if you were really technically minded, you might take a piece of string and measure 150 feet long and draw sort of an arc, right? You could draw it over there and draw a certain arc from each place. But does that information that I just gave you define one point?
It's 2 miles.
Two.
It defines two.
2 points.
Okay, and the 2 points that it happens to define, does anyone have an idea, do you think?
It's where those two arcs intersect.
So yeah.
We have the two.
Yeah, okay, what if I added one that it was 40 feet from the dining hall door?
Kind of substantial, isn't it?
Yeah.
It takes it to one point.
Yeah. Okay, the location I'm describing is about at the arc. These are rough measurements, but if you think about it, that's about 150 feet. It gets you somewhere up there in the arc. But if I just gave you the 2 points, you'd have either up there at the arc or somewhere down here in Railroad Creek, I figure, about down there in the creek. And then if I give you the third piece of information, it's going to get it down to 1 point. Okay, that's a simple example because we're here on the surface of the earth. And you can know that I'm not suggesting you go up in the air 150 feet or down in the ground 150 feet. So we're talking in two dimensions there. But we're able to define an exact location with three distances, and with just two, we're down to 2 points. Okay? But finding the distance from a satellite is a little tougher. Because we've got the satellite. Okay, I was trying to thinking how I was going to draw this. This is sort of what the satellites look like, right? They got their big solar panels out here, and then there's some, all their workings sort of in the middle. Okay, so now we know that we locate one satellite, and we know that we're 11,000 miles from that satellite, which is a rough distance that we are from. You don't just have a circle in that case, you've actually got a sphere, right? So we've got this sphere that looks like this. Okay, that's 11,000 miles. So we know that we're somewhere on the surface of this sphere if we know our distance from this satellite. Okay, now we take a second satellite over here somewhere. And we know we're, let's say, 12,000 miles from it.
These are geosynchronous satellites?
Fixed, yeah.
Almost. For some reason, I was reading that they change by 4 minutes. Each day. I have no idea why they do that.
They're not geosynchronous.
They're not quite.
They go around like 2 or 3 times a day or something. Around
here. Do they?
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's 2 or 3 times because they said they don't come back to the same place at exactly the same time.
The precess or whatever they do.
Yeah.
But the relationship to each other is stationary.
No, they're flying around all over the place.
Yeah, so we'll get to that point of how they also tell you their location. Once you know the distance, they have to tell you where they are. Okay, so what's the intersection of these? If we know our distance from two satellites, what are we down to?
2 spots, I guess. 2 points.
No, these are spheres now. You have to think. I thought of how I could bring two spheres together and like smush them together and think about the intersection of two spheres.
Oh, it's a circle. It's the fish. It's everything in between. It's everything in the crossover.
It is. It's a whole circle. And that's sort of a tough one to draw. But, you know, it's something like this.
It's the overlap.
There is a circle that's the intersection of these two.
Yeah.
So if we only had two satellites, we know that we're somewhere on this circle. Okay, so we obviously need a third satellite, and if we do that,
that crosses over.
You know, then we got another.
No, it's not.
Right. You know, we're getting a little complex. Now, what have we got as the intersection?
2 points.
Okay, so we're down to 2 points now. Now, the thing is that of those 2 points, probably only one is going to be somewhere on the surface of the Earth. The other is going to be like off in space or down below or something. And so, though we're only down to 2 points, we're not down to 1 point, we can reject one of the points because only one of them will be on the surface of the Earth. So, though three satellites don't exactly position you, it's close enough because you can throw out the ridiculous one. But we could add a fourth satellite and get a precise location, right? It's, you know, the fourth satellite would intersect either one or the other, and then we would know. And in fact, we don't use the fourth satellite for position, but we do use a fourth satellite. If any of you are used to using this, you know you need to lock onto four satellites before you can actually use it. So we need the fourth satellite, but not for that. Because with three, we're down to 2 points, and only one makes any sense. Okay, so that's point one. We're able to locate ourselves exactly because we know the distance from the satellites. Okay, and we've got three satellites. Okay, question number two. Or this is my point number two. How are we going to measure the distance from the satellites? Okay, this was all assuming that we knew.
Satellites have to communicate with each other by sonar, actually.
How do we get our distance from a satellite?
Length of time for a second.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Sonar. You all know, okay, well, even if I say, let's say if you're driving a car and you have 60 miles per hour, in 2 hours, how far do you go?
120.
Okay, so you all know that that distance, distance equals velocity times time. Okay, for that simple example, we had 60 miles per hour times 2 hours, and that gave us 120 miles. Exactly. Okay, so that's a car. The electronic from the satellite obviously is not going that speed. What's the speed of this, the signal here?
186,000.
Okay. It's 186,000 miles per second. That's the speed of any electromagnetic wave, right? Whether we're talking about light or microwaves or radio waves or whatever we're sending, they all travel at the speed of light. So that's the speed, and now we just need to know the time, and then we would have the distance. So we have the right thing here. Okay, so time is the next problem. Now, let me explain this with a goofy analogy, as they put it in a tutorial that I was reading, but I thought that it was perfectly reasonable. If they started, say that a satellite up in space started playing the Star Spangled Banner, that was there. And we down here started playing the Star Spangled Banner at exactly the same time. Of course, it would take longer for it to get to us, the one from space. And so what we could do to figure out that amount of time is to slow down or to delay our rendition of the Star Spangled Banner until it coincided with this one coming from space. And then we would know that that's the amount of time that it took to get there. Okay? Does that sort of make sense as an odd analogy? Now, of course, the satellites are not sending any songs, but they're sending a signal. It's a complicated pattern of ons and offs. And so those of you who work with satellites, I know we have at least one electrical engineer here. Are there people used to working with these things? I mean, it's your basic square wave of, you know, ons various times. But it's a very complicated pattern, apparently. And it's so complicated that they call it a pseudo-random code. But it's not random. It's just really complicated. And each satellite has its own code that it sends out. And so the GPS receiver can get synced with that code that each satellite is sending out. And that's how it figures out the time that it took to get there. Okay, so that very roughly is what's going on. You've got these codes coming down, you've got the very accurate timing in the satellite, and then you've got the timing, you've got the receiver here receiving that, figuring out what the delay between its clock and the clock in the satellite is, and that's the time. Okay, we're talking very precise times here. It's not like...
How do the clocks get synchronized?
Yeah, that's the problem, right? And it's not as if they can be, like, about synchronized. At the speed of light, an error of 1/1000th of a second, which seems pretty small to me anyway, would give an error of about 200 miles. So that really wouldn't work very well for us, because we're trying to get a lot more accurate than that, right? So, I mean, these clocks have to be accurate to, I don't know how many decimal points of a second, but many, many, many decimal points of a second. Fortunately, we have such accurate clocks, and they're called atomic clocks, and they were invented, you know, in completely unrelated research, I don't know, 20 years ago or something like that, these incredibly accurate clocks that we really can count on to keep time that accurately. That's what's in the satellite. So each of those satellites has one of the atomic clocks. Problem is, they cost about $100,000 each. So if we had to have one of those in the receiver, probably not too many of us would have these, and I certainly wouldn't have two, three sitting on the table here if they were $100,000. So that's what the satellite keeps its accuracy through the atomic clocks. These, however, don't have that accurate clock. They've got pretty accurate clocks, but not quite that accurate. So this is how the secret, as they say, to how this can be accurate enough lies in the fact that we only take three satellite measurements. That's why you need the fourth. Not because you need it to locate yourself on the Earth, but you need it to kind of synchronize your watches, so to speak. Because the fourth satellite, if it's accurate, has to intersect at one of these points, okay? One or the other of these points that we have. Now, what if it doesn't? And in fact, that's what can happen. If it doesn't intersect at a point defined by the other three, then it knows that there's some error. And this is kind of astonishing to me, but apparently within each of these little receivers, they have the software that can figure that out. That can say, okay, we need to find a single correction factor that will allow all four satellites to intersect at one point. And so it tries out what various correction factors it could, and it finds the one that works. And that's how it gets to atomic clock accuracy level without having an atomic clock. It's because of the fourth satellite.
And then what does it give you, your latitude?
Yes, it gives you your latitude and longitude. Very precisely. Yeah, I guess I should have talked about that a little bit more. But we'll get into more what it gives you, I guess, when we get these give you. I think both of these, and I don't know, here's two, gives it in degrees and minutes, and then decimal minutes. Is that how yours works?
You can set it to different.
You can set it to meters or feet or something if you want it.
Well, to minutes and seconds, or minutes and decimal minutes, or whatever.
Okay, but it's latitude and longitude, which defines an exact point on the Earth, and you could translate it into whatever else you need.
It's 3 feet or something.
Okay, so what it means is that any GPS receiver has to have at least four channels so that it can get four measurements simultaneously, but most of these receivers have more. It doesn't seem to add a lot more money to get a lot more than that. Okay, now there's one more problem. We've got the points, and we've got the distances from each of them through the time. But now the problem remains of, this only helps us if we know exactly where the satellites are, right? And we alluded to that earlier. Because otherwise it doesn't help to know our exact distance from the four satellites unless we also know the exact distance, I mean the exact position of those four satellites. The satellites were all sent up by the Department of Defense, it's my understanding, and they are in very precise orbits, about 11,000 miles up, that's roughly where they are. And of course, so they're out of the atmosphere, and so they rotate pretty regularly. And I don't have good detail on, you know, the geosynchronicity or exactly how it works, but I do know that they don't have much problem with wobble. They don't get way out of their path or anything like that. They're very good satellites. But like anything, they might get slightly out of their path. So just to make things perfect, because we're really trying to get down to those few centimeters of accuracy, there are checks that are going on all the time. And it's a Air Force base in Colorado, I guess I had the name, but I don't know. But it's somewhere in Colorado. There's the sort of central monitoring station for all the GPS. And so they are regularly with radar, I believe, monitoring where the satellite is exactly, and checking if that's where the satellite thinks it is. And if that's not exactly where the satellite thinks it is, it sends up new data to the satellite to know where it is. And so then each of these satellites at any time, what they're sending, somehow integrated into this pseudo-random code, and that I do not know how they do, but they integrate into it their position. And so it's the satellite's responsibility to know its position. And when this reads, you know, it links on those satellites, then it is finding also, it's calculating the distance itself inside the receiver, but it's getting the original position of the satellites from that, from the satellites. Okay, so those are the four main things about it. We needed to do the triangulation, and we needed to find the distance, and we needed to get everything synchronized, and then we needed to find out where the satellites were. Does that kind of make sense? Does anyone have questions or comments up to that point?
All the satellites have to be on the same side of the Earth, right?
There are 24 satellites. And so apparently this allows any point on Earth to have between 5 and 8 at any time. Except if you got mountains around you, you might not have between 5 and 8. But that's on any, you know, particular part of the Earth. There are 5 and 8 high enough above the horizon that, that you can use them. So that's how it's supposed to cover the whole Earth.
Are they all put up by the American Department of Defense?
Yeah.
And nobody else on Earth just put up a satellite?
Well, you know, I guess I'm not real sure of the politics here. It would seem to me like it's sort of generous of the Department of Defense to provide this for the entire world. But no, I mean, they don't need to because they can all get the same data as we can. We'll talk in a minute about what they do to make it less usable for people in other countries, but we'll get back to that. But it is just the American satellites.
Where's the Sirius phone system up? It's got its own satellites.
Another set for GPS?
Yeah, probably.
GLONASS.
Okay.
GLONASS is the name.
Okay, and why do they need to do that?
Probably for their own military.
Yeah, because it's
okay, so that they are, right, because that they would be doing, all right, so.
Because I don't think the United States was going to let Russia use the United States satellites.
Well, the thing is, since they were open for commercial use, they can also be used by every other military, but there is that downgrading of the resolution. So they decided that was worth it to send up their own system. Okay.
This is in the days of the Cold War, they had to do their own. This is probably all designed during the Cold War days.
It may be designed during the Cold War. I just want to stress again how very new this is. I mean, people have been using it, the system, for a number of years. But the full system has only been up and running since 94. The 24 satellite went up in 94, which really makes a big part of it. Well, that's not very long ago, considering that how much everybody's heard of it and people got all kinds of uses for it. I mean, it's not that old. Even though back in the 80s, they could do it. It's just that a receiver would be the size of a suitcase and it's cost.
So let's say the mathematically 24 is the optimum number you need.
I think it's got some redundancy there. I don't think that they probably optimized it. They
so
having sure
30 would make any difference in 24 is what they're going to do. Right,
I don't think they have plans to add any more. Now again, I have to turn to my audience here. My understanding was that 24 was their goal, and if one falls out of the sky, they'll put a different one up, or you know, it ceases to function. But that's enough, so you don't get better coverage with more satellites. Okay, so there's one more question, and that's the question of error accuracy, right? I mean, when you think about this, these signals are coming from 11,000 miles up. We're collecting a few of them. We're doing a lot of mathematical calculations in here, not just a few, and we're coming up with a position. How accurate can this actually be? Well, there's a number of sources of error, so let's look at the different sources of error. And then, of course, you add them all up as you do whenever you're looking at sources of error. It's cumulative. First, you've got the effects of the atmosphere, and apparently that does cause somewhat of a rough trip for the signal. I mean, no more than anything else, radio waves or, you know, light waves or anything, but they all get bounced around a little bit with the atmosphere. It's the ionosphere and the water vapor in the troposphere causes it to slow down a little bit. So there's, it's like there was just a little bit of a delay or a bad clock or something like that. There are very small errors that this is going to induce, but as we've seen, very small errors can lead to major errors in prediction. So that's the fact of the atmosphere itself. Then there is the problem of what happens on the ground. And it is possible that the signal can bounce off various obstructions before it gets to our receiver. You can imagine that, right? Like again, any other kind of electromagnetic wave, it can bounce off. And so we may be getting signals that were delayed a little bit because they actually came from, I don't know if buildings can do, I assume that it can, right? So you've got all those kind of things that may throw your signal off a little bit. There's a little bit of error from the satellite itself. Even though the atomic clocks are very, very precise, they're not perfect. So I don't have a clear idea, but especially between the time that the Department of Defense in Colorado monitors where they are and tells them again their exact position and their exact time, they're always updating the satellite's time, there might be some error that sneaks in during that time. So basically all those kind of things add up to the fact that we can't get it more than about 20 meters of accuracy. Even the best GPS receiver just by itself can't get better than that just because you've got those atmospheric effects, okay? There's another problem that if the satellites, we're here on the Earth, and you've got various satellites, let's say you've got a satellite here, satellite here, satellite here. If you take two that are really close together, we might have, this is the sphere for this one, and this is the sphere for this one, okay? And each of them have that little bit of inaccuracy. Let's draw it by making a line kind of thick. Let's do it that way. And especially if you take two satellites that are really close together, this area where your question is for where your actual point is going to be bigger than if you take two satellites that are really far away. Because here you have, let's say you might have your circle this way, and here you'd have yours this way. So the intersection, I don't think this drawing has done it justice. But basically, if your receiver decides to pick a bunch of satellites, let's say it picks four satellites, but they're all really close to each other, you're going to have a bigger margin of error than if it picks four satellites that scan the whole sky. So that adds error, too. And a good receiver, that's another mark of a good receiver, I have no idea if this one does it or not, will pick satellites on purpose to, if it can see, let's say, six satellites, it will pick the ones that give it the lowest intersection problem. But then, of course, the big one is the intentional error. And as it says here, as hard as it may be to believe, the same government that spent $12 billion to develop the most accurate navigation system in the world is intentionally degrading its accuracy. So this is the military problem. They don't want it to be used by, I guess the problem is especially missiles. Sent by a foreign government. Because the fact is, the system is downgraded, but you can get around that error, and that's what everybody does. The surveyors who need 20 centimeter accuracy, they get around it, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So it doesn't seem to me like it's really solved the problem by the U.S. government to downgrade the system like that, but that's what they do. And apparently this was, I was trying to read up on this better before I came here. Apparently this is going to be reviewed in the year 2000. This was one of the things that Al Gore's reinventing government noticed wasn't like all that good an idea. And then I read in another place that they're committed to take this off by 2006. Because it doesn't really seem like all that good an idea. But anyway, the military receivers can decrypt the degrading. You know, they throw in some errors. I'm not really sure how it works in the code. But the military receivers can decrypt it and not have the problem of that inaccuracy, whereas the civilian ones don't have it because we don't have the code. So the error of when I'm holding one satellite receiver, like it's even assuming it's a good GPS receiver, the error is going to be about 100 meters, or a little more than 300 feet in any direction. So that includes vertical and horizontal. Okay, so, you know, for some applications, it doesn't matter much. If I'm driving along in my car, I don't think that's a real serious error. If I'm, say, tracking my way, and Rich is going to show us on his computer how you can, you know, track along from, like, say, Chelan to Wenatchee. If you're driving, you know, how far is that? 50 miles? Whatever. If you're driving a long distance, a few hundred feet really doesn't make any difference at all. What it does is throw you off if you try and use this for hiking. You'll be able to get to Holden Village as a whole, but you might think it's odd if we go outside, and at one point it says we're at 3,300 feet in altitude, and a minute later it'll say we're at 3,100 feet altitude, and another minute it'll say we're at, you know, 3,400 or something like that. It's, the reason it's doing that is because of the intentional shift that the United States government is putting on it. You can just stand there in one place, and it's not a problem with the GPS, it's not a problem with satellites, it's that system has been intentionally degraded, so it kind of wanders around. But the 100 meters of accuracy means that 95% of the time, so that's within two standard deviations, it'll be within 100 meters. So rarely it'll be even more than 100 meters off.
The question on that
makes sense for a thermal degree.
Right, that's right. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, okay, I was afraid. If you have a really tough question to me on why this makes sense, I can't answer because it doesn't make sense to me. Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah, and then the fact that you can get around it. So
now, they use it too for artillery, too, for locating artillery.
How would you get it? What, you mean put it on some artillery?
No, on 105 millimeter shell, you want to drop right there.
Well, I mean, this is the key part of one of the key things of some kind of smart bombs, right? I mean, you can actually have a GPS receiver on a missile, and it can say, okay, I'm at this location, I'm at this location, but I know I'm trying to get to such and such location, it can keep going. I don't think an artillery shell can be that smart, right? It just sort of has its trajectory, it's going to fall where it's going to fall.
I know in the Persian Gulf War, that's one of the things that really helped their military tanks, probably missiles and everything, was everyone had GPS, and driving along this desert, there's no landmarks for 300 miles, but you know exactly where you are.
Yeah, it really sold a lot of people on it, and it was certainly after that that they got the rest of the money. I mean, it feels sort of bad talking over here in Holden Village about the wonders of this military-developed technology, and I don't know, maybe we should have an ethical discussion about the ethics of using it if we wouldn't really agree with the fantastic amount of money that's spent by your department. But I don't know, I kind of feel like this is a lot more useful than most of the stuff they do, so.
I was on a friend's boat, he has an electronic chart, and it shows the whole coastline. He zoomed in on the GPS to show where his boat was, and it brought it right down to the dock he was at. But it was jumping between the end of the dock and the berth he was in and off onto land, so it kind of jumped around.
Yeah, but at least you can get it into the right dock.
Yeah.
So that's that. It's called selective availability, this thing that the U.S. government puts on it. And again, probably early in the next century, it'll be taken off. I don't think anybody's going to make a strong case for why it shouldn't be because of this. Okay, but as I said, this is putting a 100-meter degradation on it, but we still can use it. And how can we do that? Has anybody used differential GPS? Okay, what we do is set up a base station. We set up another GPS in a fixed location. So I can set one up, you know, somewhere, let's say over at Narnia, and I put one there, and I get its exact location. You can do that by a number of means to get its location, and you give it its exact location. Then all the time, it's receiving the same satellites as I am over here, but say I'm walking around, so I want to know where I am all the time. It's also getting this wandering sort of path while staying at the same time. So you can see how I could use that through subtraction, you know, figuring out what the difference is between its real location and its measured location at any time, and then subtract that same thing from mine. So either the one way to do it is, you know, the cheaper way is to just have a fixed station there. I go out and map whatever I need to map. Say I'm a geophysical surveyor, I go out, and then I come back in at the end of the day and I do some post-processing with my computer, and I figure out where I actually was, because my GPS knows where it thinks it was, and that I match up with that. So that's one way to do it. All this is called differential GPS, and it's a way of getting around the error that you can't avoid plus the intentional error. But that doesn't help, for example, these precision farmers. That's what I know best. Or in fact, anybody who's trying to get locations on the go. You want the right location while you're at it. So what a bunch of people have done, there are commercial services, and then the Coast Guard does this as well for the sake of the boats. So if you're close to a coast, you can get it for free. They have base stations very accurately located that are getting this all the time. And then they send out, I think most of them are by FM radio, they send out what their, you know, movement is due to the intentional and unintentional error. And then, so another part of a differential GPS receiver is the FM receiver for this continuous updated corrections that you get. So that's another thing that goes into your calculations of where you are at any minute. And so I was surprised to find how widely available this is. Again, the Coast Guard is putting them up everywhere, I suppose originally for the Coast Guard boats, but hey, everybody else can profit for it. It's out there in the air, and you can take it. We even do in Indiana, because there are some in Lake Michigan, so we can get them there along the coast too. Otherwise, you can subscribe to a commercial service that sends it out, and you just pay to subscribe to this thing, and it's the same kind of thing. Now the question is, why wouldn't the enemy military do the same thing?
Subscribe to the same service.
Yeah. So this is not clear to me. Yes.
I know I'm in the search and rescue in my King County over on the west side of the mountains. And I know this coming weekend, there's this place in our county called Tiger Mountain. It's really close to Seattle, very popular. We end up looking for a lot of people there and injuries and whatnot. Well, no one has any good maps. But this a member of our group was able to get a hold of by a company, I think the company's called Trimble or something.
Mm-hmm.
GPS is a new system that they've just come out with recently for the weekend, and I think it does all this different, like right there, like I'm hiking down the trail. Is that weird? That was the thing this weekend, they're having everyone map all the trails, you know, hike them or bike them or drive them. And I think the system, you know, you got your base station, you got all these little boxes in the packs, and it does it all and maps it all out right there as you're walking down the trail.
Yeah, it's a wonderful application of this technology. Let me just mention, before we go to the hands-on part, that the GPS walks hand-in-hand with another technology that's called GIS, which you may or may not have heard of or used. That's actually what I use the most, Geographic Information Systems, which is basically the computerized mapping system. Of course, we who use it don't like to just call it a computerized mapping system. We call it a computerized analysis, geographic analysis system, because that is the difference between just, you know, hard copy maps and the computerized maps that you can do analyses. And what I do is hydrologic modeling where the water goes in a landscape. I'm sure if you're a geophysicist, you do the same kind of thing. You're trying to model what's happening on Earth. And so the computerized information of what is there is very useful. The reason these are so closely tied together is because, just as the kind of application you said, what you have at the end of that is a whole series of point locations, right? You'll have thousands and thousands of points where you were, which doesn't do you a lot of good by itself. It's still not going to make a map. But a geographic information system, or GIS, can map those lines and make it into a nice map. And in fact, put it in conjunction with all the other things we probably know about the landscape. The soils may be mapped on the geographic information system, the areas where there's forest, all the other things that we typically map with geographic information systems, you can integrate with that kind of a thing. That's exciting to hear about.
Now, can you use this day or night the same? I mean, does it doesn't matter?
Yes, I believe so. Mm-hmm. Does anyone else? I can't think of any reason you would not be able to.
Like the radio, you know, nighttime is a different reception than the daytime.
Yeah, so I did that. So I can't think of anything that would change it. It may change a little, but certainly people use it. And again, in the Gulf War or something, that's when they loved it especially. But airplanes are using it both, you know, they're using it at all times. Other questions or comments? Okay, when I said that I was going to do this again, I didn't know how it would work out. I thought one of the best things was how well the title fit into our theme for this week. So I hope that was a draw for you, since we're talking about guiding our feet. But one of the things I learned is that Rich here has a system that he has a more elaborate system. And I thought maybe we could take a minute. Can you show people or just sort of walk around with it? So just show them briefly how it works in conjunction with an Atlas program. And then what we'll do is take the receivers outside, and this is a lot of people, but you'll all be able to at least look at it to some extent to see how we get the satellites, and you can see which satellites are there. Both of these receivers are, I think, oriented towards navigation, tracking kind of things, you know, hiking, driving around in your car. So they've got little mapping programs in them, which is sort of interesting, but I have to say that I haven't even figured it all out myself. But you set a waypoint, you can go back there and things like that. But you get a little map of the satellite, and then you can see what your location is. Does anybody know the latitude and longitude here at Holden? I was going to have a map as a check, but I think we'll find that this is an adequate source.
Some of the systems advertise locking on, you know, not four satellites, but six satellites or eight satellites. Does that really contribute to accuracy, or is that just sales hype?
The more satellites, I think the more accurate you're going to be.
I would tend to think, because it would cut down that possibility of, you know, they've all got to meet in one point then, and you certainly are going to increase your accuracy. To me, that would make sense. I don't know what kind of price range you're talking to get more than six satellites. These were about $200. This was a year ago, so it's probably less than that now. Maybe it's down to $100. I don't know right now.
I've seen some advertised for $99.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what it's coming down to.
The $99 ones might not have a graphical display. That may be what you lose. So for about $150 or so, I think you can get ones that do have a map, a low-resolution map. And you can get pictures of where you've been.
But this is all a big difference than just a few years ago when this was a, you know, several thousand dollar technology. It's really come down into the hands of what people can do. We're at about 48 degrees something latitude, right? The 49th parallel is the border, isn't it? The Canada border, I'm thinking. So we're at 48 something, so you'll find out what we are exactly at. And then, of course, you know, that's the latitude, okay, going around this way. So we're up at the 48th parallel. And I hadn't done this before I came, so I was just making a rough calculation of what's 1 degree at this latitude. Does anybody know offhand?
The distance? What's the distance of 1 degree?
Yeah.
About 360 in the water with that.
Yeah, and so it was about, let's see if I can draw that page. It's about 66 miles is 1 degree of, that was of longitude. So basically, the reason I wanted to do that was because these receivers, I don't know what your depth was, goes up to 3 decimal points of latitude and longitude, okay? So a number might look like this, 48 degrees, 3.625 minutes. Okay, that's the kind of accuracy that we're getting here. I don't know why I picked 3. I think it's a lot more than that. But anyway, 3 decimal points in the minute. And that minute for the latitude, which is our north-south, is about 6 feet. This is roughly done with no calculator at Holden. That's about right. And then our longitude, it's something like this, west 100 degrees, you know, 42.641 or something like that. And this final digit here is about 4 feet in the longitude. Because you all know that, right? If you get a topographic quad map here, it's pretty much in a rectangle. I mean, of course, it's actually a quad. But anyway, 1 degree this way is considerably more than 1 degree this way because of where we are on the Earth. But they give them to this level of latitude and longitude. So that's the kind of information that you see. But of course, those last, let's see, that was, what did I say, this one was 6 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 60 feet. So we started believing this one, I mean, this is going to be right to 600 feet. So that one's going to be right. These others are going to kind of wobble. So, but it won't be 30 because it won't be in feet. But these are the ones that we have questions about. Then it also gives the altitude, and so that would give something like 3219 or something like that. And so that actually gives it in feet. And I think somebody said the actual altitude here is about 3,300.
That's
3,200 is the actual. Okay, well, it's going to vary. I know that mine varies up and down around that point. So. So do you have something that you can show people real quick, and then we'll go outside? I don't know. Can you just walk around and show people, or can they see? Can you see anything from there?
No, almost everything. I can kind of tell you what's here. Basically, this.
And then just come by and look.
The Alarm Street Atlas USA is a program that's on a CD, and it has maps of just about every road in the entire United States. And in this case, I don't have a CD drive here, but I have extracted Chelan County, and it's on Chelan County is on my hard drive. So it has all roads and streets and lakes and all those features. And by connecting the UPS to the computer, the Street Atlas program knows how to listen to the GPS. The GPS tells it where it is, and then the program can make a little spot where you are. And if you're moving, it can draw a little arrow and draw a series of arrows where you are, and that's basically the idea. So it's kind of fun. I've taken it with me when I'm driving on a long trip, and I can just see where I am. I can see what's nearby. Oh, there's a lake over there. There's always there.
And you can mark the waypoints, and then you can follow those back if you choose.
You could.
Mm-hmm. How many people can get on one of these satellites at one time?
It's just broadcasting out like the radio.
It's just broadcasting out, so it doesn't make any difference.
Right? No, so no limit. We can always.
So we're just like the million radio receivers. We have a million of these things up there. Okay.
So why don't you come up here and just sort of file by and line and look at this? It's quite interesting to see this map. And then we'll walk out just in front of Toyota and look at the GPS. Okay. So as soon as if you're done looking here, then just come out in front of the building, and hopefully there'll be a chance for everybody.
Everybody has to. All the time.